Okay, this being our final hour here tonight with Peter Ward, we'll take your phone calls as we talk about a new history of life. Okay, welcome back. Peter Ward with us. We'll get to your calls, too, right here on Coast to Coast AM. As you look at all the episodes that are out there that we're being bombarded, what about the possibility that this planet will get some kind of virus, not necessarily man-made, but a virus that we just can't stop, Peter? Is that possible?
Sure. I mean, anything is possible. We know we've had enormous pandemics in the past. Let's just take something like the common cold. We all get colds. I mean, I defy you to find anybody who doesn't at least get a cold once every few years. I mean, most people get a few. They get the sniffles. Now, tie up that cold with, say, 90% fatality. And that's a bad news business. So if you have a virus that sits on a countertop for a few days, which is what our colds can do, it just sits there. You just brush your finger against it. You somehow lick your finger, bang, there you've got it. Luckily for us, these most really long-lived and easily infiltrating viruses that we have in our lives now, that they aren't huge killers, but they certainly, you cannot say that evolution won't just, through random mutation, produce one of those.
All right, to the calls we go. Let's go to George in St. Louis to get things started. Hello, George. Go ahead.
Good morning. You mentioned humans as being a combination in the future of, like, Borg, where they're both their software and a biological organism. The point I want to make is you don't have to go that direction, that the future computers would be a combination of both a hardware and biological interface. That what I'm saying is computers aren't sentient, but biological organisms are. The biological organism would be creative and could invent, and you'd have that aspect, and you'd be able to use, obviously, the hardware to carry it out.
What do you think of that, Peter?
I was really struck, and I mean, it's a great comment. I was really struck by friends of mine who do work for SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence.
Do you know Seth Shostak?
Very well.
Yeah, he's a good guy.
We call each other the evil twins. I call him my evil twin. I'm the evil twin.
Doppelgangers.
We are great friends, actually. Because we've debated, we've fought. I mean, we've had these memorable debates. But it was Seth, in fact, and I'm glad you brought that up. Seth is saying, the last time I talked to him, he said the more he thinks about it, the more they believe that aliens trying to get hold of us, in fact, will be mechanical. They will be next generation. There will be evolution has moved past the wetware and gone into, I mean, it might be synthetic biology, but he doesn't think it's going to be organisms evolved coming out of the mud as we have. He thinks it's the next generation of artificial computers and artificial intelligence that is a combination of hardware and software, but it will not be evolution that produced them. The soft creatures like us will evolve better machines, more intelligent machines. That's what they think they'll hear from outer space.
Armageddon. We hear that word a lot. End times. Man or nature? If you had to guess on the next extinction, which would it be?
Well, I think it'd be a combination. I think it's man messing with nature. I mean, we are nature, George. We are biologically produced. Evolution put us here. We are just nature with a really advanced technology. But I just think the catastrophes, when they happen, they could be so awfully just moving fast and the rapidity of them that I think what we have working for us is our great intelligence. But I still see, I mean, just what you said, that they sent smallpox to all these different, or anthrax, whatever it was, anthrax, to all these labs by some clerical error. Well, just think of that writ large, and you certainly see where humans could certainly produce some very nasty effects in the biosphere.
First-time caller, Cody, welcome. You're in Las Vegas, and you're now on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, Cody.
Hey, good morning. Hey, Peter, do you have a theory on why we went thousands of years pretty much in the dark. I mean, even though there were great men throughout history, geniuses, but it was the first of the last century and these last 100-plus years that we've really come this far. Is there a reason for that? Do you have any kind of theory on that?
Yeah, well, part of it is how much have we revered intelligence through time? I mean, really, if you look at the people who can sit back, and I'm one of these gifted people that I could work at a university. I have plenty of time to think. I mean, I do lots of other work. I teach. I have service jobs. But if you go back, say, 400 or 500 years ago, would society have allowed people to just sit around and think great thoughts? And then secondly, technology. It's the combination of people who have time to think out of the box, but also the ability through technology to create machines and the biological and the mechanical aspects. I just think that thinking people like we have, the engineers and the technicians, were not revered in the deep past. I mean, many of them were thought to be sorcerers, and there was fear of them, that they were not given the position to be able to influence society as much as now we understand that society can be bettered by science. It's not always been that way. I mean, I don't know. I think it's a great question. I just think that we are now in a position where we are not afraid of breakthrough.
The changes that occur on this planet will occur. Are they slow, or are they going to speed up?
Well, you're going to have both kinds. Sea level rise is going to be slow. It's going to be so slow that from decade to decade...
You won't see it coming. It'll be so slow, right? And then one day, boom.
Well, other things are going to be fast. When you get one of these great storms that comes whipping through, and we can certainly see that with warming in places that haven't warmed before, you're going to have this a great amount of storm material. I mean, George, look at some of the sizes of these huge icebergs, ice mountains, ice islands that are breaking off Antarctica. I mean, this is unprecedented.
Let's go to Don in Wheaton, Illinois, east of the Rockies. Good morning, Don. Good to have you with us.
Yeah, hi. How are you doing?
Good.
I've enjoyed your show, and I just wanted to maybe add a little bit here. Peter recognizes that, the west side of the United States is very hot, and yet we're getting all of this cold and moisture over on the other side. And both NASA and Scientific American magazine have written on this, there's a jet stream, an Arctic jet stream that goes up there, and it's responsible for a lot of the weather. They've only known about it for about 75 years that it's responsible for the weather. But what's happening is because the Arctic is melting and warming so fast, the wind up there, it's called a jet stream, is up there by where the jets fly. And normally it goes by very fast, but because of the differences in, it's no longer cold up there, and normally it goes in a straight line. But because of that, it's slowing down, and it's slowing down so much that the cold and the warm is like meandering. And so you're getting these dips down, like the South was very cold, during the winter. And that's happening out. It's like we're caught in a rut out in the West. It's just so hot, and it's because of that jet stream meandering. And normally it goes around in a straight line. I don't know if that makes any sense, but that's what I've heard in several.
It's dipping of the jet stream. And the thing is that we live in North America, and this is our entire world. But I just spent the last year in Australia, and Australia is in one of the greatest droughts in their history, and much of the southern hemisphere has been experiencing hot weather like they've never seen before. You have to look at the globe as a totality, but we are seeing perturbations in weather. And once again, I mean, you go back 200 years, maybe we didn't have the people who were able to understand weather well enough. Maybe we're just seeing a repeating pattern. But at least within my lifetime, we were certainly seeing a pattern of increasing droughts in places where we need crops to grow. It's just that we have such a thin edge now of error because we have so many people.
All right, next up, let's go to Chattanooga, Tennessee. Hello, CW. Go ahead.
Good morning, George Norrie. How are you?
We are awake. We are great and awake.
Thank you very much for taking my call. Sure. And I wanted to ask Dr. Ward about human blood group systems. I was just reading on Wikipedia that scientists have now identified 35 different human blood group systems, and they're citing the International Society of Blood Transfusion for that information. And then I was reading in Smithsonian Magazine about the association of blood groups with immunity to various diseases or vulnerability to various diseases. And thinking about that, and then I looked up the distribution of blood group globally by location, and it doesn't make sense logically for the disease interaction of the human immune system to DNA, RNA, for that to explain the origin of all these different blood group systems. And I wondered what Dr. Ward thought about that.
Boy, you're stumping me. I know so little about blood groups and their origins from an evolutionary point of view. We are, I think, just starting to scratch the surface of understanding how such variation really occurred and how these various blood types themselves have occurred. I wish I could tell you more. I'm going to plead ignorance on this one, if that's okay. I can't help you on this question.
Isn't it amazing also how this planet has remedies for just about every ailment? You just have to find it. How can that be, Peter?
Well, we've got, part of it is the diversity of life, and I think you brought it up, George, and you beautifully said, why do we have such this gigantic diversity? But, I mean, plants are able to produce so many different amazing compounds, and because we have so many different kinds of plants, and we've had faith healers that are really been pretty intelligent through many, many different cultures. It's not faith. It's the fact that they can use a whole variety of compounds coming from various plants. I mean, we look at medical science now and say, aha, it's got to be modern to be right. Well, that's not true at all. I mean, people, societies for thousands of years have known how to use various plant species for remedies. But part of that goes back to the fact we have this enormous biodiversity. And one of the great tragedies is if we are in a sixth extinction, we lose that biodiversity. And we lose compounds that maybe we have diseases that haven't appeared yet. And they're coming, and their cures are going to be found in plants that are still here. If you lose stuff, you shut down your ability to use these biological drugstores.
You sure do. Hey, CW, thank you for the call. Let's go to Jeff now in Goldsboro, North Carolina. Jeffrey, go ahead.
Hi, Peter. Hi, George. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
Peter, I have two related questions. One is the in your book, the Medea hypothesis, I think you advocated populating the galaxy with life and intelligence as far as we can. Do we have a moral imperative or moral obligation to do that, to populate as much of the galaxy with intelligence that we can? And two, what do you think about the technological singularity? I'm sure you've thought about that. Is that a good thing, a bad thing, likely, not likely, near term, far term? Artificial intelligence, what do you think about that? So do we populate the galaxy as much as we can and the technological singularity?
Well, the first question is a fascinating one. I don't think I advocated that we should populate the galaxy, but I think, in fact, if many of these planets could never rise to intelligence, I think that we're just going to have life appear, it's going to live for a while, it's going to kill itself off or be wiped out by asteroids, but there will not be the technology to save it. It just seems to me that we humans we want to travel. Now, one of the scariest things is, what if it turns out that through physics that we are never capable of sending enough humans in our present form even to the closest stars? I mean, when you think of something as only 5 light years away, sounds like a very small number until you try to figure out what a light year is. I mean, I love science fiction, and you look about these big generation ships where you try to build these enormous ships. But one of the scariest aspects to me was the Biosphere project. I mean, this gigantic structure in the Arizona desert where they were going to let, 4 or 5 or 6 humans live there for 5 years. And this thing was bigger than any spaceship you could ever imagine. It was enormous. It had its own little separate worlds. Try to think about that size of a spaceship, and that thing failed. It failed utterly. I mean, they had to flee for their lives, I think, after less than a year.
Because technologically it failed, or they went nuts?
Well, they both happened. Well, but yeah. The humans, what happened worse was that technologically it failed. They started losing their systems. Their plants could not keep the oxygen levels to where they had to be. They had all kinds of breakdowns. And this is in a place where you could actually call out and get another set of nuts and bolts instead of being halfway to Alpha Centauri. Just the amount of effort and the technology necessary to get to the next star system, if you don't believe in beam me up, Scotty, if that could never be possible, that might be really hard to do. In terms of the technological singularity, I think technology is in our DNA. I think we're just going to continue to try to advance things, and I'm just hoping that it is hopefully in the major surface of it is to make all of our lives better.
Let's take a few more calls before the break. Idana is with us in Johannesburg, California, west of the Rockies. Good morning, Idana.
Good morning, George. I know you're a good egg, and Peter's got a very good vibe, too. I love his honesty. I'm wondering, I live up here in the Mojave Desert as a crow flies, about 20 miles from Death Valley. I'm wondering, Peter, have you ever done any research on some of our petroglyph and jade paintings here in the area?
I've actually had a chance, though, to look at some of the amazing petroglyphs in Australia. And Australians, the first humans didn't get to Australia until about 50,000 years ago. And so this really one of the oldest societies that we know of that decided that we're going to start making art. And some of the stuff that these Aboriginal cultures have produced on these rock walls are just really phenomenally amazing. It's really that the boat is still out on really when humans finally did get to North America. When I went through college, it was thought that the Clovis people didn't get here until 12 to 14,000 years ago. But now we're finding evidence that 30,000 years ago, there seemed to have been humans in North America. But they didn't leave much of a record. And so much of the petroglyphs, much of the Native American art that's present is a few thousand years at most. And yet we have in Europe, we've got 24 to 28,000 year, the Lascaux cave paintings, the fantastic stuff. But the Australians may have been the earliest painters on Earth, because we can go back 35 to 40,000 years there where they have put art on walls. But here's a question for you. Why would art evolve in the first place? I mean, why all of a sudden do we feel we need to be graffiti artists? That's an interesting evolutionary question. And is there any evolutionary use to it, or is it just something we do randomly?
I also like what you brought up earlier, Peter, about how mankind just went along and then all of a sudden creativeness popped in. And something happened, definitely.
Well, something really did happen. I was at the most fascinating conference earlier this year at Arizona State, and I got to meet the person who knows more about Neanderthals than anyone. It's Pablo Cervante is his name. And he was the man, he's a German, who found or was able to break out of a finger bone of a Neanderthal DNA. And so this was for the first time you could compare human DNA to Neanderthal DNA. And what I found fascinating was that humans left Africa, and we had a bunch of these migrations going out of Africa. And about 35 or 40,000 years ago, a band of humans going out of Africa met up with Neanderthals, which seemed to be a separate species, in what we call the Middle East now, and there was interbreeding. So there was some successful part Neanderthal, part humans, and this guy Cervante was saying that any of us, in fact, could be from 2 to 4% Neanderthal.
That could be. That's interesting take. Let's talk a little bit more about RNA and wrap things up with final calls next, Peter. On our next Coast to Coast program, Timothy Green Beckley joins us. We'll be talking about his work in the paranormal, and also, of course, Robert Murch joins us. He is the world's foremost collector and expert on Ouija and talking boards. Yikes. But he's going to talk about the popularity of that horrible new game, Charlie Charlie, which is believed to summon up a demon from Mexico. So make sure you're part of the program tomorrow. We're coming back in a moment with Peter Ward as we talk about his work, A New History of Life, and your final phone calls. Okay, welcome back. Our final segment with Peter Ward here. Peter, RNA, ribonucleic acid, of course, is essential as a building block for life with DNA. Can you have one without the other?
Yeah, probably the earliest life on Earth was RNA without DNA. the first life on this planet appears to be what we call RNA life. And then DNA just piggybacked upon it and took over and stole the world from them. I mean, bring back the RNA. No, maybe don't bring back the RNA. We still have RNA life. It's called viruses.
Yeah, we do. And how come those little critters are so tough?
Yeah, the viruses are fascinating creatures. They don't live in cells like we do. They don't have every cell wall is made of fat. It's horrible to say. I mean, my entire skin seems to be a fatty cell wall. But viruses have a protein coat, so they're tough and they're tiny. And they've figured out the keys to the kingdom. They can work their way into almost any cell. The virus is one of the most fascinating studies ever. Every DNA on this planet, every creature with DNA, it's all the same kind of DNA. And yet the earliest life must have been a million different kinds, everyone different. Why would you have only one kind of genetic code? Well, a great genius here named John Barrows, University of Washington, has suggested that viruses, because they could go in and out of every cell, they standardized everything. When a virus goes in, it steals DNA and puts in other DNA. It swaps it back and forth. It homogenized all of life. So we can really thank the viruses for Earth life as it is now.
All right, back to the phones we go. Let's go to Joni in Scottsdale, Arizona. I'll be there sometime this year for a major conference. Hi, Joni. Go ahead.
Thank you very much.
Sure thing.
I'm ecstatic I got through. I heard just a small portion of Peter's segment on crows.
Yes.
And I lived in Scottsdale for 16 years, and I have never seen so many crows, like he had mentioned, and I thought I was going crazy watching their calculating way of communicating and trying to get all the birds' nests and eating the eggs. And my mother, I just got back from Minnesota. My mother passed away June 9th.
I'm sorry to hear that.
And I never seen, I mean, hundreds of crows. Now, I don't know if that's normal for Minnesota, but this is just when he started mentioning their communication and their, I mean, I was looking at this going, my God, they're calculated the way they're working together and trying to get birds' nests and eat. So what I'm saying is, Peter, it validates I'm not going crazy with my observations.
No, you're totally correct. I mean, it's all over the country. Crows are increasing in population at the cost of all the other songbirds. They go into those nests. Crows are amazing carnivores, and we have a few bald eagles left up here. If any eagle comes anywhere near the crows, the whole crow patrol is after them. But here's what scares me. Generally around my house, there will be 10 or 15 crows, but every once in a while, you'll find hundreds to thousands of them congregating from everywhere in the city into one giant flock, and they sit together for a day or two, and they go back to their territory. I mean, what are these things doing? We are so underestimating crow intelligence.
Are they vicious?
Oh, yeah. Yes, absolutely. When crows are nesting, they will attack humans. They'll come right at you. I mean, these crows can be... I actually had a book called Future Evolution, and at the very end of the book, I posited that they were the next great global intelligence in hunting down humans, because they could certainly do it.
Next up, we got Tom in Grantville, Missouri, east of the Rockies. Tom, go ahead, sir.
Hi, good morning, fellas. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I wanted to ask Peter if... he had, in the absence of a creator, and I'm going to have you put your Monday hat on so you're not in church. In the absence of a creator, do you have any kind of explanation for the ultraviolet oxygen paradox in creation on whether it be Earth, Mars, or wherever you think life started? And I'll take my call off the air. Thank you.
I'm a little unfamiliar with what that paradox is. I'm not a great physicist. I wish my co-author, Joe Kirschnick, were here because he certainly knows a great deal more about the physics of light than I do. George, do you understand what the caller is
saying? No, I don't understand that aspect as well.
I mean,
and he hung up.
But so. I don't quite know what the paradox is.
As we look at the next 20 years with mankind, do you see any more dramatic changes for us, planetary, personal?
I certainly see that as population keeps going up, that we're going to have ever more problems with food supply. But on the other hand, technology is certainly, at least up till now, we're not seeing massive famines to the point where, even when I was a kid and later in the 60s, we had the terrible famines in Biafra, and we had some of these African famines. We seem to be doing better in that respect, but I really see water shortages, and I think this is the biggest problem facing us. The fact that we've got places where it used to snow all winter, and now it rains, and all that water, which used to sit up there as snowpack, has disappeared. And you know this is happening in many places. This is, especially in the Himalayas, where we have these huge populous Asian countries. Water and the lack of water, I think, is going to be the greatest single challenge.
Well, I think so, too. And it's going to be a huge challenge and a frightening challenge.
Yes.
Why don't we do desalinization plants?
That's too expensive.
Yeah, but, I mean, at least we'd have water.
Well, yes, it's funny you say that because my father in the 1968 had a patent for the best desalinization plant ever, and it was bought up by the Boeing company, and they put it back in a safe and hid it away. But it was predicated on 25 cents a gallon gasoline.
Jeez.
Yeah, well, that was the good old days. Remember, in the 60s, you could get gas for 25 cents a gallon, and desalinization was a going concern. Energy is expensive, and I think we could go to desalinization if we covered huge areas of the desert with solar cells, next-generation solar cells. We're going to have to make those choices about giving up deserts. Certainly, Australia has a huge outback area, but to give up desert, to cover them with solar cells, you're killing species. There's going to have to be triage. Civilization is going to have to come up with triage. We're going to have to swap out species for ever more humans and make these choices.
All right, next up, let's go to Annie in Alabama. Hello, Annie.
Thank you, George. I have read that thousands of homeowners in the inner city of Detroit were run out of their homes by the city. Of course, half of them were never eligible for public housing, and they've got thousands of homeless now. And I just wondered, Dr. Ward, have you ever heard of a land grab that involves the city running homeowners out of their homes and using drug setups to furnish the buyer, they furnish the seller, they furnish the dope, and the homeowner doesn't have to have anything to do with it? They also condemn people's homes, claiming that there's rats around, making up stories about the houses being in hazardous condition.
Annie, I think you're off topic there for a little bit. Stay on topic. Sorry you can't help her on that one, Peter.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that.
No, not at all. In our solar system, we have a sun. Could it be responsible for everything that's happening climate-wise?
Could be. I mean, this is the thing about science, is that there's no absolutes. Just anybody who says that we know exactly why things are happening, forget it. Certainly could be. The solar cycle ideas cannot be rebutted. The most abundant evidence that's out there suggests that it's greenhouse gases that are causing this rapid warming. But we don't know enough about the sun. I mean, I hear climate scientists try to bend over backwards to accommodate as many theories as they can. But, I mean, there is this, a sense of ego in that community as well as we know. I mean, you just have to approach this stuff with the sense that we haven't been able to measure stuff for long enough. We know what the preponderance of evidence now suggests, but boy, there's no absolutes. I mean, there's no proof in science. There's probabilities, and you've got high and low probabilities, but we may just all be fooled. I mean, we've been fooled by so many things. Cold fusion, we were fooled by all kinds of stuff in the past.
Next up, let's go to David in Virginia. Welcome to the program, David. Go ahead.
Yes. Peter, I'd like to ask you, if I may, please. Thank you for taking my call, first of all. I'd like to ask you, if I may, you had talked about mankind possibly inducing the dying off of species. That being the case, wouldn't mankind have been doomed from the start since millions of species came and went long before we were here? I'll take my call on the air. Thank you.
I got to get my head around that one. We certainly have caused the eradication of subspecies. And we know that there have been, I mean, there are far more extinct species in the geological past than are ever present on the Earth at the present time.
And maybe more to come, Peter.
And there may be lots more to come, but I'm not exactly certain how to answer that question or where it's going.
Are we destroying the planet?
See, that's the funny thing. Planets are really tough. You can't destroy
them. They are tough, and they bounce back.
They do, and you can certainly destroy species. Biology is certainly not as tough as a rock is, but the biospheres themselves, they can't be destroyed. They can be changed. I mean, this is the whole deal, is that we're really seeing nutrient cycles changing. We're seeing how just geological processes change, but the thing about life, you know, it's just like Malcolm in the old Jurassic Park. Life will find a way.
Mm-hmm, sure will.
Evolution is set up in such a way that, yeah, species will die and somebody else will take its place.
If Darwin were alive today and was witnessing everything that's going on, would he change any of his thoughts and theories?
Yeah, I think this whole idea that we call epigenetics, I think Darwin was such a great mind that he would see what this evidence is and how it works. You should have me on for another show about evolution itself in the future, because we can barely touch on it, but there's such cool stuff that's coming out about that. But what I wish Darwin could see is that the whole science of genetics, none of that was present. Darwin would love this idea of DNA and the genetic code. The one thing that I really take issue with Darwin about, Darwin hated the fossil record. And he just railed on and on about how poor the fossil record is. And we have such good techniques. Darwin, I think, would be entranced. And maybe he would take back some of that nasty.
He might. Was it bad, though, then, during his era?
He hated the fossil record because they couldn't explain that the sudden appearance of trilobites. And these are these complex crab-like creatures. And the reason being is they couldn't see the smaller fossils. They didn't have the tools to see them.
We have Lauren in Rolla, Missouri, first-time caller. Hi, Lauren.
Hi there. Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
You too. And I need you off your speakerphone if you can.
Oh, I'm sorry. Hang on.
Okay. Because
I have hit my speakerphone.
There you go.
That helps.
Much better.
All right. Very good. Okay. So I'm just calling. I'm an environmental scientist from Missouri, and I'm just calling to try and offer some sort of a solution for the a few problems that seems to be plaguing humanity right now. Aside from overpopulation control, which really, as you've noted, is kind of the problem. Aside from that, I think like the drought in California and our dependency on petroleum products. For a few years now, the solution seems to be to me to switch to alternate forms of energy, and in particular for California's sake. And any other arid parts of the world where water is a problem. I feel that desalination plants that run on renewable resources such as tidal power, wind power, solar power, using these renewable electricities to split the seawater into its most basic form, taking up the oxygen and the hydrogen from the seawater and extracting those gases, and then recombining them to produce, clean water. And you can run cars off of it, and, you could probably drink it, and what you do is pump it in from the ocean, and you would extract as much of the gases as you could from it and recombine it, and, I guess you would. It's not really burning it, it's combusting it. You could have, a power plant set up next to that to generate electricity for the cities nearby and produce water, I feel like that could be a big solution to a lot of the problems here, and I was just wondering what you thought as far as the solution goes. What do you think about that?
Well, you're right. We really need as many different types of energy solutions as we can get. But the thing about water, to do it, you've got to boil water to get that salt out of it, and to do that takes a huge amount of energy. It's almost a zero-sum game. The sense is, yes, you could do that. You could bring all these other types of energy in, but some other area that's using that energy now would be subtracted from. I mean, you've got a sense that we are just sort of barely struggling getting by with at least local energy. Fracking, with the natural gas revolution of the last 5 years, is one of the great surprises of my life. But we know that there are problems with that. We know there's freshwater problems. You know well that around the fracking areas, it takes so much fresh water. So we're getting energy, but it's costing us fresh water, and we need more fresh water. So, again, none of these things is a panacea. I think it's going to take a little bit of everything, and we certainly need to increase solar. And I still think that we can just use better nuclear energy plants. I don't see, with the world population being what it is, how we can stay away from going nuclear. I hate to say that because of the waste. And yet, otherwise we're looking at massive die-offs of humans, and nobody wants to see that.
So if you looked in the headlines in the future, over the next 5 years, what might they say, Peter?
Oh, I think the biological revolution is going to increase. The fact that it's getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper for us to read DNA molecules, that the cost is going down so much that I think we're going to find one of the cool ideas that we've played with in Australia, and I think is very cool. This may sound like pie in the sky, but we're going to be able to design food for specific people. One of the things, designer wine. People are looking at, do your DNA scan, and we'll find exactly the best kind of wine variety for you. So cheap technology that's going to increase our health, I think, is going to take place. I think we're going to get more and more pharmaceuticals that we can grow using these biological techniques. It is going to be the century of biology. After the last century was really the century of electronics. And we're going to get living organisms to do much of what electronics does now. And we're going to have these computers that are running through biological systems. And I think that's really where the direction of things is going.
Is there anything you would flag that we should avoid?
Well, I think at the moment, I think you hit it. I think what's really scaring me more than anything is genetically modified foods, to the point that there are not controls in place. We
That's
do not
right.
yet understand how easy it is for genes to jump from one organism to another. We talked about viruses.
Mm-hmm.
Viruses carry stuff from thing to thing. There is not enough control on that yet.
And don't you think Mother Nature would have made the foods the way she wanted them? And if GMO foods were the way to go, it would have been done on this planet.
Well, evolution certainly plays with a lot of things. I mean, agriculture does make improvements in food, and we know with the number of people we have and the number of mouths we have to feed. I mean, we are heading past 7 billion people. I mean, George, when you and I were kids, it was a lot more than
it
that.
It sure was. Peter, thanks for being on the program. His book is called A New History of Life. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Borelson, George Knapp. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.